From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, singer Mel Torme looks back on the start of his singing career, way back to when he was 4 years old. Torme has a new autobiography and a new record. Also today, I speak with exiled Soviet poet and dissident Irina Ratushinskaya. For the 3 years that she was a political prisoner, she scratched each new poem on a bar of soap, then committed it to memory. She's written an account of her imprisonment and the international campaign that forced her release. Lloyd Schwartz has a review of new recordings of Tchaikovsky's second and third piano concertos. And our urban legends expert Jan Harald Brunvand returns to Fresh Air. Today, an account of how New Zealanders have adapted classic apocryphal stories from America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Singer Mel Torme has been performing for 59 of his 63 years. His days as a child singer through his years as a top-billed entertainer are chronicled in his new autobiography, It Wasn't All Velvet, a reference to his nickname, The Velvet Fog. Although Torme is best known for his singing, he's also an arranger, pianist, drummer, actor, and songwriter. He wrote the Christmas song, the one that starts chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Mel Torme has a new record. It's called Reunion, and it reunites Torme with the Marty Paich Dectet, which he recorded with in the 50s. Before we meet Torme, let's listen to a selection from this new album. This is More Than You Know.
Whether you are here or yonder, whether you are false or true, whether you remain or wander, I'm growing fonder of you. Even though your friends forsake you, even though you don't succeed, wouldn't I be glad to take you, give you the break you need? More than more than you know, girl of my heart, I love you so. Lately I find you're on my mind more than you know.
Mel Torme, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be with you.
Your singing's very beautiful on this new record. The song we've just been listening to, More Than You Know, no real embroidery on it, no scat singing, no embroidery, and I wonder how you decide when you're going to sing something fairly straight, true to the melody, and when to embroider on it.
I think a little embroidery, Terry, goes a long way, and particularly in ballads. I think you have to be true to what the composer and the lyricist intended originally, and if you're capable of, as you say, embroidering, I think you do it very, very judiciously.
Since you have a new autobiography called It Wasn't All Velvet, I thought we should take this opportunity to look back on different aspects of your life. So why don't we go back to your childhood, when you were 4 years old and when you were already starting to sing in front of audiences Monday nights with the Coon Sanders Nighthawk Band. Describe the atmosphere just a little bit to give us a sense of where you were at this young age.
Well, if I remember it rather vividly, believe it or not, even though I was only 4 years old, and it was redolent of that period of time. It really reeked of the late 20s, the beginning of the Depression era in the 30s. The Black Hawk was rather rococo. It was rather gaudily furnished, if I remember correctly, but in a strangely, and I know this is a contradiction in terms, a strangely tasteful way. The band was The band sat on the stand with all those wonderful burnished horns. In those days, big bands didn't use a bass, a string bass. They used a tuba for the keeping of time along with the drums. And it was, for me, it was absolutely thrilling because as a child, I mean really as a child, I listened to the radio a great deal, particularly that band, and hearing them come through the loudspeaker with the tinkling of silverware and the murmur of the patrons, and then somebody saying, "Here it is, the Coon Sanders Nighthawks Orchestra," and them playing on so many of the radio shows that I listened to actually be there, and then to actually stand up on that stage and sing with that orchestra at the age of four, I'll tell you, it's Shangri-La.
Well, the band leader had asked you to sing a song because he saw you sitting very well dressed and obviously very enthusiastic about the band, and he liked your singing so much he asked you to sit in with them every Monday night. I think that there's the possibility for it to be very damaging to a four-year-old to sing with an orchestra every week. You can be patronized, encouraged to be very cute, and to form bad habits. And I was wondering if that ever happened to you.
Absolutely not, but I don't blame myself for that. By that I mean I don't credit myself. I credit my family. We have very, very strong fabric in this family. We're all very closely knit. The values of my mother and father were purely Midwestern, plus Jewish. They're, not that they were Orthodox Jews, but they had very strong bound principles. And there's no way that little Melvin Howard Torme, and in those days it was Tormy, by the way, we added the accent many, many years later, there was no way that he was going to run amok. No possible way. So I think that even being in the business that early, if you look at the upside and the downside, it was definitely an upside for me.
Since you started performing so young, it meant you were probably singing to audiences when your voice started to change. That's, I think, usually a very embarrassing time for boys because you don't know when you open your mouth what's gonna happen. Did that give you problems?
It did as a radio actor. I was a child radio actor from 1934 to about 1940. And when my voice did change, all those real kids' parts that I had, I was in that strange transitional period vocally where I wasn't being offered as many child radio acting parts as I had in the past. But by that time, I was so immersed in jazz and the playing of drums, in singing, even in this, you know, sort of 14-year-old froggy voice of mine, that really, I didn't really notice too much in the way of transition. Everything seemed to just kind of shift gears and go, I would say, rather smoothly.
Mm-hmm. You were on the road, I think, for the first time when you were about 17 with the Ben Pollock Band. And what was it like to be 17 playing with a lot of guys who were, for the most part, considerably older than you were?
It was tough. And by the way, Ben Pollock put that band together, Terry, but it was the Chico Marx Band, you know, the Marx brother who played piano and used to shoot the keys when he zipped up the upper scale of the piano. It was tough. I got a lot of comeuppance, as they say in the Magnificent Ambersons, and some of it was deserved, frankly. Some of it wasn't, but I can look back now and realize that it was the natural progression of youth, you know, puberty, adolescence, and you finally get to be a young man, and then you get to be an old man if you live long enough.
What did you have to do to prove yourself?
I think, well, a couple of things. First of all, as I mentioned, and it wasn't all velvet, they were absolutely determined to see me finally and irrevocably lose my virginity. And the whole band seemed to be in on this, and it finally happened in Pittsburgh with a very lovely woman who was considerably older, not considerably, but somewhat older than myself. And, no, wait a minute, I guess considerably. I was 17, she was about 34. But generally speaking, I think the only way you can prove yourself with the older element of a band like that when you're as young as I was literally to keep on keeping on, to just keep learning, to try to do better all the time, and to prove yourself by virtue of your professionalism. I think toward the end of the tenure of that band, which was, I think the band broke up in July of 1943, and I was on my way to go do a movie at RKO. I'd been discovered by a talent scout in New York. I think by that time, that I had made my peace, and they had indeed made their peace with me, with virtually every member of that band. I don't think I walked away from the band with any enemies.
Mel Torme is my guest, and he's written a new book called It Wasn't All Velvet, It's an Autobiography. A couple of years before you went on the road with that band, when you were 15 and still in high school, the Harry James Band recorded your song Lament to Love. And I'll tell you the truth, I'm not familiar with the song. Could you hum a line of it or recite or sing a chorus? Or I don't know the song.
I'm not terribly good at that without a piano, but it was, Terry, a minor key song, kind of an inoffensive, and I must say rather innocuous little love song that Harry James seemed to like, and he recorded it, got on the hit parade. When you say you're not familiar with the song, don't feel too bad, Terry, because not too many people were. But it did get on the hit parade, and it stayed on the hit parade about 5 weeks in the number 7 and number 8 position out of 10 songs. The main thing is it was not only recorded by Harry James and Les Brown and Sonny Dunham's orchestra and Lanny Ross, a very popular singer of the day, but it was also played incessantly over the airways by literally every major band in this country. Every band made, I shouldn't say that, not every band, but most bands made an arrangement of it, and you'd hear it nightly by people as diverse as, the Louis Armstrong Band and Fred Waring and his 50 Pennsylvanians. So the truth of the matter was that it got great exposure, and I, as a baby songwriter, I was only 15 when I wrote it and 16 when it came out, got an awful lot of press out of it.
Well, when you were playing a song for Glenn Miller, Miller said to you, don't write Moon, June, Spoon kind of lyrics. What effect did that have on you? Did that make you think more about rhymes?
Oh, absolutely. Not about rhyme. Not about rhyme. Because that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about content.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about making pictures with lyrics. And he recommended that I listen to every lyric that Johnny Mercer had ever written. And he was absolutely right. Mercer became my role model as a songwriter and lyric writer particularly. And I began to realize that you could write something, I don't want to say profound, but redemptive in the popular song field without literally leaning on the tried and true narrow parameters of the popular song.
I want to ask you about a song you wrote early on in your career called Born to be Blue. Did you write this after Glenn Miller gave you his little lecture?
Oh, yes. At least, I think it was 4 to 5 years after I spoke to Glenn Miller. And I wrote that with Bob Wells, who was my songwriting partner.
That's true. You didn't write the lyric.
Well, no, that's not true. No,
oh, okay.
No. Bob Wells and I were a team in the purest sense of the word because Bob was extremely musical as well as an extremely fine lyric writer. And I was purely a lyric writer as well, hopefully, as a composer of popular-type song music. So when we worked together, even on the Christmas song and Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, he contributed to the melody, I contributed a lot of the lyrics. And that's the way we worked.
Let me play a recording that you made of your song Born to Be Blue in the mid-40s with Sonny Burke and his orchestra. And let's listen to a little of Mel Torme singing his own song, Born to Be Blue.
Some folks were meant to live in clover, but they are such a chosen few. And clover being green is something I've never seen, 'cause I was born to be blue. When there's a yellow moon above me, they say there's moonbeams I should view. But moonbeams being gold are something I can't behold, 'cause I was born to be blue.
That recording was made in the mid-1940s, and I want to talk with you more about what your singing was like then and how it's changed. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Mel Torme, and he's written a new autobiography called It Wasn't All Velvet. And he also has a new recording that's called Reunion, Mel Torme and the Marty Paich Dectet. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mel Torme is joining us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Let's get back to the mid-1940s, around the time that the recording we just heard was made. You sang at the Copa in New York at that time. And this was a turning point for you in a way, kind of a bad experience. You'd gotten this big build-up as the Velvet Fog, which you were nicknamed by one of the New York DJs. And you thought that build-up really worked against you in performance.
I'm not so sure about performance, Terry, but I think it did work against me from the standpoint of the fact that I was sort of shoved down the New York collective throat. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of course, the critics, the people in the press media, the print media, they all said basically to the disc jockeys, quit inundating the airwaves with this guy and telling us that he's the greatest thing since chopped liver. We'd like to discover that for ourselves, not have you. There was great rivalry, particularly in those days, between the power of the so-called disc jockey and the press. Who was more influential? And I was kind of caught in the nutcracker.
You were also kind of caught in the middle of two generations, too, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I came onto the Copa stage at a time when the Copa was playing nobody except the considerably older performers, the Sophie Tuckers, the, you know, Joey Lewis's, Jimmy Durante. Those were the staples at the Copa. Now, here comes this squirt from California, and he's going to entertain us? Come on. And consequently, I really got my lumps at the Copa, some of which, again, I deserved.
Well, you said you had to sing in a falsetto then, and listening to your records from the mid-40s, I don't hear what you mean.
No. I don't know where that came from, but I don't even know how to sing falsetto. As a matter of fact, you know, my range in the last several years has increased on the upper end as well as the lower end by at least three or four, maybe five notes. And when I sing very high notes in some of the records that I've made with George Shearing and even on my own, some absolutely ill-informed critics say he even sounds good in falsetto. I can't produce. I don't know how to produce a falsetto note. What those notes are what singing teachers call covered tones. They're done up in the head, but they are absolutely pure. They have nothing to do with mechanical or ersatz formation of notes. I didn't sing in a falsetto way in those days, Terry, but I did sing in rather a wispy, kind of creamy, and I felt rather callow way. And consequently, I couldn't bear to hear the sound of my voice on records in those days. Not that I'm that wild about it today, but at least now I can tolerate, because of the aging process, because my voice has deepened, and because I think I've learned a little more about singing than I knew back in 1947 at the Copa, I can tolerate what I record on record.
Well, I'm afraid I don't really understand why you couldn't tolerate what you did before.
I think it's very much like talking to some of the actors, for instance, that I'm sure you've spoken to from time to time, and they say, oh, boy, that early movie of mine, oh, please, cut it up and make it into banjo picks. I think I always look back upon my early work, and as a matter of fact, when I look back upon last week and say, what could I have done better? That's what I'm looking at when I look at the early things, and I just felt that they were just a little too juvenile-sounding, a little too young-sounding to please me, certainly at this point in my life.
Well, you've said that you used to sing in a head tone, and now you're singing with your diaphragm.
Right.
What's the difference between the two, and how did you start to change?
I think you mainly produce head tones, obviously, in the head. Breathing, of course, is everything in singing. But I taught myself to breathe through from the diaphragm. And I can produce notes now that are very powerful. I'm a far, far more robust singer than I used to be in those days. And that is more pleasing to my personal ear. Beyond that, as I say, I taught myself my own sort of breathing exercise to the point where I can hold a note, for instance, at the end of a song almost interminably. And I think that's terribly important that you're able to control your breathing, particularly for phrasing of lyrics.
Well, here's what I want to do. I want to play a record you made in 1956 of Nice Work If You Can Get It, the Gershwin song. I don't know what you think about this recording, but we're about to find out. and I should mention, as you probably know, that this was singled out by the people who did the American Popular Song Anthology for the Smithsonian Collection of Recordings. And this is a collection of some of the greatest American popular songs. And they did their attempt to find the definitive recordings of these great songs. And so your recording of Nice Work If You Can Get It was chosen. This was made in 1956. I should say it's with the Marty Paich Dectet, which is the group that you are reunited with on right. Your new record. So let's give this a spin and then see what you think of it.
Okay.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask for anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
It's Mille Torme as recorded in 1956. So what do you think?
Not bad.
Yeah, I concur.
Well, I wasn't that terrible. No, actually, it sounds pretty good. I was sort of hit and miss in those days because I was still earning my wings. My whole career, as I point out in this book of mine, is a work in progress. The learning curve is always there. Whitney Balliot did a big profile on me in the New Yorker magazine about 4 or 5 years ago. And when he asked me why all this wonderful stuff is happening for me right now, this tremendous renaissance of my career and everything, I looked him right in the eye and said, Whitney, I'm learning how to sing. And he really gave me a look that said, my God, what an ingenuous remark. I said, no, Whitney, don't look at me that way. I'm telling you, point blank, I am learning how to sing. I do that, Terry, literally every day of my life. And that's not a phony modesty remark. I am, I think, on a daily basis, learning a little more about myself, learning how to be more consistent, how to concentrate more on what I sing. And I hope that's to the good.
You know, I think the curse of a lot of singers has been being given material by record producers that isn't suited for them, that they don't want to sing. And I think you've been through periods like that during different parts of your career.
Well, I had some misplaced values. I thought that it was very important to be recording for people like Columbia and Atlantic Records and Capitol Records. These are big majors. But I also found out that you can get desperately lost in the shuffle.
Ahead. There's a record of yours from I guess it's the early 60s where you sing Secret Agent Man and If I Had a Hammer. Now, there's nothing wrong with those songs, but I don't think they're the right songs for you.
They really aren't. And again, we were at that particular point. I can only tell you this. If you read my book, you know that at that point in the 60s, I gave really serious thought to chucking it all and becoming an airline pilot. And for the best part of well over 2 months, I was calling aviation schools and thinking about the fact that I'd had a very good run in this business. The public had been wonderful to me, but maybe it's time to move on. I'm grateful now that I didn't, because the pendulum has swung so far back in my direction that I get on my knees every morning and face Mecca and thank God that what's happened has happened. But, you know, you are right that I did get, there were some songs foisted on me by some of these major companies that I had no business singing, and I rather regret it.
Let me ask you a question that will probably strike you as very naive. When you're
This strikes me as very naive, Terry.
When you're arranging for the band, and when you're hiring the band yourself as the singer, you're rehearsing them during the week, trying to get the sound that you want in back of you for your performance.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then when the performance is actually happening, you have to really let go and at least act like you're falling into a rapture as you're singing the song. You have to really at least give the impression of losing yourself in the song. Is it ever a little hard to do that, knowing also that you're the boss? Does it ever make for a kind of a dual role that's sometimes hard to play?
Yeah, it probably is a little hard to play, but I've never seen a singer worth his salt, any singer that I admire, who wasn't also a good actor. Because I think that every song you do is a little one-act play. Even if it's an innocuous song, even if it's one of those ephemeral things that comes and goes, basically it's a tiny little story, and it should be acted out. And that's why I'm very careful about what I personally orchestrate for myself. Obviously, it's a great eater of time, arranging, as I told you. So I'm tremendously selective about what I will choose to orchestrate, because I want to get a lot of mileage out of it, A, and B, I want to be sure that that song is eminently performable. Some songs are better left. I mean, Secret Agent Man. God, you really dredge that one up, Terry. I must say, that's a song you put on record. You know, it's almost a gag. You do it, you get rid of it, goodbye. But a performable song, like, for instance, More Than You Know, like the two Donald Fagen tunes that are in the new album, and particularly recently at Michael's Pub in New York, when I really took a quantum leap and did the soliloquy from Carousel, which is a very strong and serious piece of music. In those instances, when I write them, I make sure that I am going to get longevity out of them and that they are, as I said, at the risk of overusing the phrase, tremendously and eminently performable before an audience.
Well, Mel Torme, we're out of time. I thank you so very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Pleasure.
My guest has been singer Mel Torme. He has a new autobiography titled It Wasn't All Velvet, published by Viking. He also has a new record called Reunion. It's on Concord Records, and it features him reunited with Marty Paich and his Dectet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, our guest will be British journalist William Shawcross. His new book, The Shah's Last Ride, The Fate of an Ally, tells of the fall and flight of the Shah of Iran. Shawcross is also the author of the award-winning book, Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. I hope you can join us.
When you weep upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Irina Ratushinskaya spent 3.5 years in a Soviet labor camp for the crime of writing poetry and documents in defense of human rights. Coming up, the exiled poet tells us how she survived her ordeal and how she continued to write throughout her imprisonment. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Tchaikovsky's little-known second and third piano concertos. And after 6 months of traveling throughout New Zealand, Jan Harald Brundtvand returns to Fresh Air with word that the best urban legends can be adapted to any culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. In what AIDS activists are calling a pre-election gambit, the Food and Drug Administration today announced a plan for speeding up approval of drugs helpful to victims of life-threatening illnesses. Commissioner Frank Young said the new procedures would be similar to those used to gain approval of AZT, an AIDS drug approved in 2 years. The commissioner says there are 2 new drugs, one for AIDS and one for cancer, that have been marked for the speed-up process. Young gave prominent credit for the FDA changes to George Bush, the chairman of the Committee on Regulatory Reform. George Bush said today he would call for a NATO summit meeting if he's elected president. In his third foreign policy speech this week, Bush also asked Michael Dukakis to join him in opposing unilateral withdrawal of troops from Europe. Details from NPR's Phyllis Crockett.
The vice president pledged his support for NATO and the Allies. He said all should pay their fair share, but did not say specifically that the Europeans should pay more than they are paying now. Bush said it would be dangerous to prepare for conventional force negotiations by removing U.S. troops from Europe.
Now, after the INF Treaty, when conventional defense is receiving renewed attention, about the worst thing we could do would be to shake European confidence and to worsen the conventional imbalances through such a move.
This afternoon, Bush was greeted by cheering high school students and other supporters at a high school in Royal Oak, Michigan. I'm Phyllis Crockett with the Bush campaign in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Michael Dukakis has stated the same position as Bush, favoring negotiations for conventional arms cuts in Europe, but Dukakis has called for even greater reductions in Warsaw Pact forces because they outnumber NATO troops. Dukakis met with a group of farmers in Hull, Illinois today in a session that was broadcast to 20 states. 5 Israelis are reported dead and at least 11 others injured following a suicide bomb attack on an Israeli convoy in South Lebanon today. A Shiite Muslim group in Beirut claimed responsibility for the attack, which took place at a border checkpoint. 2 passenger planes in India crashed in bad weather today, killing as many as 160 people in the separate incidents. More from Justin Webb in New Delhi.
130 people died when the first crash happened at Ahmedabad in the western state of Gujarat. A Boeing 737 plane owned by Indian Airlines was nearing Ahmedabad on a flight from Bombay. It crashed in thick fog about 2 miles from the airport. 5 people survived, including a 13-year-old boy. He and 3 other survivors have been badly burnt, but 1 man escaped without serious injury. Soon after the Indian Airlines crash, news came that a 2nd plane belonging to India's other domestic airline, Vayudoot, was missing. It was later confirmed that this plane, a Fokker Friendship carrying 34 people, had crashed in thick forest in the eastern state of Assam. Reports from the scene said the plane had come down in heavy rain. Because of the remoteness of the area, it will be impossible for rescue teams to reach the site until tomorrow, and there's thought to be little chance of finding any survivors.
The BBC's Justin Webb. After destroying and flooding tens of thousands of homes in Colombia, Hurricane Joan is headed for Central America. The government of Costa Rica has evacuated the elderly, children, hospital patients, and prisoners from coastal cities. Joan is the 5th hurricane of the season. 3 Americans were today awarded a Nobel Prize in Physics for their work on neutrinos, subatomic particles that have no electrical charge. Leon Lederman, Melvin Schwartz, and Jack Steinberger will share the $400,000 prize. And stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street on this anniversary of the market crash last year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 22 points to close at 2137.27. Declines led advances 2-1 on volume of 186 million shares. This is NPR in Washington. I'm Sharon Green.
This is Fresh Air. Tchaikovsky is better known for his orchestral music than for his piano works, with one exception, his piano concerto in B-flat minor. It's a standard in the classical repertoire, and even provided the tune for a pop song in the 40s. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz wants to bring to our attention two lesser-known Tchaikovsky piano scores.
If you base your knowledge of Tchaikovsky only on what gets performed at concerts, you'd probably think he only wrote one piano concerto. But he actually wrote three, and the other two, written 5 and 18 years later, aren't so bad that they don't deserve to be played more. In fact, if you attend the New York City Ballet, you probably know the second and third better than the first, since George Balanchine choreographed two marvelous ballets to Tchaikovsky's other piano concertos. And in some ways, they are such appealing works precisely because they are so lilting and danceable. The Arabesque label has just issued the only currently available recording to include both the second and third concertos on a single disc. They are uncut performances and include passages you won't hear at the New York City Ballet. The second concerto is the big one. It's probably performed in concert so rarely because the piano part is so difficult, although early critics attacked parts of it for being more like a symphony with a piano obbligato. But some of the piano writing, especially in the ambitious first movement cadenza, is very impressive, intricate in texture and engrossing in structure. One of the most appealing features of the second piano concerto is the element of chamber music. Parts of the second movement, with its extensive solo work for violin and cello, sound like a piano trio rather than a concerto. I wish I liked this performance better. Sergio Commissione, now chief conductor of the New York City Opera, is a musician I respect. I hope when he's in New York, he crosses the plaza at Lincoln Center to see Balanchine's great ballet. He'd see how much grander, how much more expansive the music is than he allows it to be on this recording. Balanchine originally called it Ballet Imperial. I miss the broadness of the opening bars, for example. We should feel the grandeur of the imperial court, not the haste of a tourist being rushed through the Tsar's palace. The pianist is Jerome Lowenthal, who handles the technical difficulties but plays down the delicacy and fantasy. The piano part can be as fanciful as the Nutcracker Suite, but here it's all rather straight-faced and colorless, and always a little too loud. The piano itself is rather clattery, and the dry recorded sound doesn't add much atmosphere. Tchaikovsky had originally planned a symphony instead of a third piano concerto, then changed his mind, rewrote his one completed movement and called it a concerto. It's marked Allegro Brillante and that's what Balanchine called his short yet dazzling romantic ballet. The performance here goes better. It has the headlong sweep and thrust, if not quite all the rhythmic bite it needs. These are performances respectable enough for getting to know these unfamiliar scores, but they miss a lot of what makes the music special.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new arabesque recording of Tchaikovsky's second and third piano concertos. This is Fresh Air. Gray is the Color of Hope is the title of a memoir by exiled Soviet poet Arina Ratushinskaya. Gray refers to the color of the uniform she wore for 3.5 years while in a Soviet labor camp. Ratushinskaya was 29 years old in 1983 when she was convicted of writing poetry and documents in defense of human rights. But imprisonment didn't silence her. While in prison, she composed more than 300 poems. Each day, she would recite 20 to 30 of them, trying to commit to memory, which she was not allowed to write down. Ratushinskaya shared a special zone of the camp with 10 other women who were also considered dangerous political prisoners.
We were very different, all of us. One lady was arrested because she organized a sort of Catholic Sunday school for children. It is crime in the Soviet Union. Other was the member of Helsinki Watching Group in Moscow. It is crime again. One woman was an artist working for underground feminist magazine. So all of us were especially dangerous state criminal. And our idea was to forget about all differences in nation, in religion, and to support one another, to help one another, even in small steps. It kept us alive, all of us.
Do you think that the women political prisoners had a different way of coping with prison life than the women who were there on criminal charges? Since you were doing hunger strikes and trying to defy the authorities in every which way you could.
Of course, there is the difference. We, all of us, had some ideas about human rights, and we learned the experience of the last generation, how to survive, how not to be broken down. We understood, even if we will die in the labor camp, we have something to die for. Ordinary women who are in the labor camp for criminals, about half of them are innocent. They are arrested for such things. They should never be arrested in normal countries for being unemployed or homeless or something like this. Half of them are just people in trouble. They are suffering, but they don't know what for.
How were you able to keep writing poems when you were in prison? What did you use to write on?
Sometimes it was sheet of paper. Sometimes it was bar of soap. Sometimes it was a service of our iron stove. It didn't matter for me on what to write. Sometimes I composed my poems on the snow surface. Anyway, I knew they will search me and confiscate all my handwriting. Only one thing they couldn't search were my brains. I had to memorize my poems.
Did other women in the prison also memorize your poems to help you remember them?
Oh, yes. All of them helped me to hide manuscripts sometimes when we had occasion to smuggle out this manuscript from the labor camp. And they helped me. They learned these poems by heart in case I will die.
You went on several hunger strikes. During at least one of them, the prison guards were afraid that you were going to die. So they force-fed you. One of the reasons I think they were afraid about your dying is that you had become fairly famous abroad. Your poems had been smuggled out. Your reputation was spreading, and there was an effort to get your release. Did you know about that? Did you know that there was such an effort to try to win your freedom?
I had no any idea about how many people are working and trying to help me. When we were in the labor camp, we didn't get any letter from abroad. And only when I was released, I learned that thousands of people from various countries wrote to me, protested near the Soviet embassy, did whatever they could to help me. Only one thing I'm sorry about now is that, well, I'm lucky, I've got this publicity. What about other people who are not poets, who are not writers? They're honest people, much better than I am probably, and they have spent much more time in the labor camp than I did. Just because people don't know their names, who will help them, my friends?
Are you trying to work for them now?
Yes. I keep in touch with the Soviet Union, sometimes by phone, sometimes secretly, using our special ways. I know what is going on now in the labor camp, and I always use each opportunity to speak about people who are still behind bars. When people don't know, they are not responsible. Knowledge is responsibility. If I have an opportunity now, I would like to say about one of these prisoners.
Please, why don't you tell us about one of the prisoners that you know of who's still in the Soviet Union?
This guy is not a poet. He is not a writer. His name is Boris Mityashin. He is truck driver from Leningrad. He was arrested first time when he was 19 years old because he protested against the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia in 1968. Second time he was arrested 4 years ago for keeping in his home books by Solzhenitsyn and my poems. Now I am free, I am released. My poems are published everywhere. And he is continuing to serve his sentence, partly for my poems.
The order for your release was signed 2 days before the Reagan-Gorbachev summit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Glasnost has helped political prisoners in the Soviet Union?
I think it was not the good wish of our authorities. I think they just used me as a coin for change, as a nice gesture. Well, I understand it is impossible to demand immediate changes in economy. It takes years. But it takes only a couple of hours to unlock the doors of the cells and let everybody go. And they release only those who are well known in the West.
How is your health now?
Some problems were removed very easily by Western doctors. Some problems like headaches, I have got 2 concussions in the labor camp, will remain forever. Doctors cannot do anything about it. My main problem is being able to have children after the labor camp. Our labor camp doctors made fun of us. They said, "We assure every one of you, you will never have children after this cold and malnutrition and everything together." Well, I still have this problem, and I still hope sooner or later doctors will help me. I wouldn't speak about this problem, but this problem is common to all women prisoners in our country.
You write in your new book that when you were in the punishment cell, you had the most beautiful dreams, and that you thought the dreams helped save you because at least when you were able to sleep, you would be taken away to these beautiful images. Did you start dreaming about prison, though, when you were released?
Yes, our psychology working in a very interesting way. When I was in the labor camp, not me, not my husband, didn't have any nightmares. Our dreams were wonderful, with music, with bright colors. When we discovered us out of danger, together, happy, having medical help, everything we have seen before came back to us in nightmares. We really couldn't sleep, both of us. Probably it was sort of reminding of our duty. I had to write a book about it. By the way, after I finished, these nightmares were gone.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Irina Reltushinskaya lives in exile with her husband in London. Her memoir, Grey is the Color of Hope, is published by Knopf. Her prison poems are collected in the book Beyond the Limit, published by Northwestern University Press. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and get a preview. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
Any big campaign stories tonight?
Well, we do. In addition to our reports on what Michael Dukakis and George Bush set out in the campaign today, also Nina Totenberg reports on the Quayle campaign, and we have an interview that she did with the Republican vice presidential candidate. Also, news of today's Nobel Prizes announced in Sweden. The prizes today for physics and chemistry. Physics to 3 Americans, chemistry to 3 West Germans. And we'll also hear from Sir Ranulph Fiennes, who is billed as the world's greatest explorer, and hear Bob Mondello's review of the new film about Charlie Parker, Bird.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We are pleased to welcome back our urban legends expert, Jan Harald Brunvand. Jan collects and analyzes modern apocryphal stories, you know, impossible-sounding incidents that supposedly happened to a friend of a friend. Jan has recently returned from a 6-month tour of New Zealand, and he's got a report on what he found there on the urban legends front.
Down in New Zealand, I found plenty of urban legends, some of them new and some recycled. It happened that my book, The Choking Doberman, had arrived in New Zealand in a paperback edition at just about the time I did. A fellow who worked for the distributor of the book there told me that as soon as he read the title legend in the book, he realized that he had heard the same Choking Doberman story told by a man in his health club in Auckland. His version was much like the one that I had traced to ancient European legends and documented as existing all over the United States. A burglar is discovered after a large dog, having bitten off the intruder's fingers, goes into convulsions. A veterinarian extracts the fingers from the dog's throat, and the police find the intruder hiding in the house. The New Zealander's version supposedly happened in Wellington to a friend of the brother of the man in the gym. That was just the first of many legends I heard there. One New Zealander told me about 3 middle-aged ladies from his country who, while on holiday in the States, had suffered a most embarrassing experience in an elevator in Los Angeles. Or was it Las Vegas? He wasn't sure. While they were on a lift, a tall black man leading a big dog on a leash stepped on and said, "Sit." The three women sat down and waited fearfully to have their money stolen or worse. "Don't tell me," I said. "The man was Reggie Jackson, but he was speaking to his dog, right?" "Who's Reggie Jackson?" my informant said. "It was Lionel Richie, the pop singer. He was speaking to his dog, though. I heard it from this bloke who knows this bloke whose mother was one of the ladies." Well, I made a note that the elevator incident, a common legend in the United States and England, is also known in New Zealand. Another Kiwi told me about a bridegroom who abruptly called off his wedding at the end of the ceremony, telling the wedding guests that the bride had slept with the best man the night before. The incident occurred in Hamilton, he said, or maybe it was Christchurch. I hated to tell him that I've collected versions of the legend I call the bothered bride from all over the United States. In most American versions, however, the groom had slept with a maid of honor and the bride calls off the wedding. Every legend I heard had some tiny wee New Zealand twist to it. New Zealanders, especially those in the South Island, say tiny wee a lot. It seems to be the settlers' Scottish background showing through. Now and then I also heard legends that sounded rare or local, such as the horror story of the man caught in the Petone shingle crusher. Petone is a city near Wellington, and shingle is gravel used for road surfacing. The crusher is a huge piece of machinery that makes little rocks out of big ones. Someone told me the story about a man who became trapped in the Petone shingle crusher. There was no way to dismantle the machine to free him. Whether they started the crusher again or left it idling, the man would die. So they called his wife to come over and kiss him goodbye. Then they gave him a heavy dose of painkillers and sorrowfully restarted the machine. That's a pretty twisted tale, I guess. But as a matter of fact, I had filed another version of the last kiss told to me back home in Salt Lake City a year or so earlier, wondering if its very unlikely plot would turn out to be traditional. I traveled a long way to find an answer. The only difference between the accounts was that in the American one, the man was trapped in a piece of steel rolling equipment. Of course, neither the Kiwi nor American informants for these two stories knew anyone personally who witnessed the accident, only an alleged friend of a friend of the victim. Hearing these urban legends, I felt right at home in New Zealand, even if they do drive on the left, place the hot water taps on the right, arrange numbers counterclockwise on the telephone dial, put salt in the shaker with one hole, and add spaghetti to their list of pizza toppings.
Jan Harald Brunvand is a professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, as the baseball season wraps up, we hear about the game's earlier years from baseball writer Noel Hind. Hind writes about the game when it was young, rash, and often brutal. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker discusses the conflicting portraits of the late John Lennon in the film Imagine and in Albert Goldman's controversial biography, The Lives of John Lennon. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Another Woman, Woody Allen's new film starring Gina Rowlands, Mia Farrow, and Gene Hackman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Becky Thorne, and Lisa Bruton, who also directed today's show. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.